So you see with the various police forces that are there and the political leadership, such as it is, that the police are used in evictions, that the pattern of arrests have a racist quality to them, that the people have been kept in the stricken city after the storm by the police. What I'm getting at is there's a systematic nature of power in the United States, but exemplified in this stories from New Orleans. And the role of security is more to protect property than it is to protect rights or people. And the most outlandish examples of this, I think, are there in New Orleans, but this is true here in Seattle and other places as well. I'd like to talk about this, the march that we put on over the Gretna Bridge, which is the main bridge between East and West Mississippi. This is a massive bridge, you know, with, I don't know, six lanes on two bridges, six lanes in each direction, and it's about a mile long. That was the bridge where the Gretna police stopped the people escaping Katrina and sent them back in the city. And the point of the march was manifold, but mostly to reenact and, in a sense, to shame the powers that be for keeping people in this flooded city, and to reenact the march over the bridge successfully. In other words, being able to get to the other side of the bridge and into Gretna, but just as a symbolic act. There were the speakers at the rally before the march were many, but I wanted to talk about just three of them. One of the other leaders, besides Malik in the area, one of the native New Orleanians who has galvanized around herself a group of people trying to provide solidarity with the community and make people's lives in these stricken areas doable, is Mama D. Mama D was, you know, maybe fifth or sixth at the podium at the rally before the march. But she's a powerful speaker. What I want to describe is the sort of tone and thoughts that these different speakers exemplify. Mama D's tone is angry, just from the beginning to the end of her speech. At the end of her speech, for instance, she says, after she's described the interactions and harassment that her community has gotten in the 7th Ward, she says, "The police may come after me, but I'm not going down alone." In other words, she's threatening. It's a counter threat. She feels threatened by the police, and her statement is that if they come in shooting, which is not beyond reason, she's going to shoot back. But she also says, "Where are the bodies? We want our people back to bury, and so that we can know what happened." And that's a quote from her speech. And what she's talking about and what she described was that her experience and the experience of people around her was that people wading through the water in the 7th Ward were shot by vigilantes and white supremacists. Their bodies were then put in shipping containers and hauled off to who knows where by police and the infrastructure of New Orleans around the 7th Ward. And so in her speech, she's saying, "Where are these bodies? We want our people back to bury and so that we can know what happened." So the instances that she's describing in her speech are sort of the most egregious human rights abuses. Now, I can't validate or invalidate what she's saying, but I can imagine the truth of what she's saying. And I was hearing stories on the radio of that level of brutality before I left for Katrina. She also describes in her block of the 7th Ward, which is virtually the only inhabited block, There's no power. There's power on to the north, to the east, to the west of her, within two blocks. Power meaning electrical power, and there's power within two blocks to the south. So she's surrounded by electrical power and had been at the point when she was speaking for 2 weeks. But they will not power up her house. And one might ask themselves, okay, well, why is Mama D, or why are she and her people being selected for that sort of neglect? And I think the reason is simple, and it's that she is a node of resistance in a city that the powers that be do not want to make her life more convenient by having electricity. And so the mostly uninhabited areas around her get electricity, and she doesn't. Malik also spoke at the rally, and Malik's tone is this moderated picture, but also a picture of injustice and corruption and murderousness, in a sense. One of Malik's stories is about a body that's left to rot in his neighborhood, and every day he gets up and he calls the powers that be to come and collect this body, but they don't for 2 weeks, and the body sits out under a piece of tin in the sun and decomposes. And where bodies are picked up in all the better areas of town without much hesitation, you know, within a day or two. So why is that kind of neglect going on at Malik's house? Well, I think it's the same reasons. And Malik elicits these stories, but with a much more moderated tone than Mama D. But I would characterize his tone as this, is that he offers something to the powers that be, and he offers solidarity and a stand your ground or hold your ground aspect to the people within the movement and within common ground. So they feel able to make demands for electrical power, for water, for help in reconstructing their homes, for a life better than the pretty depressed life that, or economically depressed life that they had prior to Katrina. In other words, they want something better. They don't want to go back to the status quo. The status quo stinks. One of the last speakers was Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney. She's often a hero of the left in this country. But I didn't find her speech heroic, and I found it troubling, in fact. She began this way. She said, "I know I speak for everyone when I say, we're not angry. We're just disappointed." I don't think she spoke for many people in that crowd, and she didn't speak for Mama D, who was clearly angry. She doesn't speak for Malik, who is clearly carrying a sense of injustice for what he sees around him. And disappointed isn't what you get when somebody leaves a body in your neighborhood to rot. It's more than disappointing. The lack of response, the sense of people are dying around you because the responders are either disempowered to respond or not allowed to respond. And it certainly makes you angry. And it's a just anger. It's an anger that motivates you to change the system, to get the world to spin on a better axis. So I felt like Cynthia had adopted a very passive position when only an active position can, and a position geared to movement style of politics as opposed to electoral style of politics, can begin to address the issues in New Orleans. And I think that's true also for the rest of the United States. But those were just three of the speakers. There was other speakers. The person who actually headed this march, I don't even remember his name. He's a rap reverend, and I'd never seen or heard such a thing, but he spoke, and he spoke also with anger and a sense of injustice. I want to move on to the story of looting in Algiers and Gretna, and as I compare and contrast the two. I was building a clothing distribution center on one of my days off from building the shower, and the neighbor, a black woman, her daughter and her granddaughters offered to stay and watch my tools while I had to go both shopping and to go back and get a generator. And in other words, I couldn't carry everything to the site where I was working all at once. It was really necessary that somebody sort of mine the tools, because otherwise they might be stolen. So she did that. In fact, did that all day long. Her name was Gail. At the end of the second day, when I'd finished building the shelves and racks for the clothing distribution center, I asked Gail something that had been on my mind, which was, how was the looting here? And her eyebrows went up in her New Orleans accent, which I had a lot of trouble with. She said everything was looted. And I looked at her and I say, everything? And she said, no, all the businesses were looted. She says, every business in Algiers was looted. I thought, well, gee, that must be disappointing, and you must be disappointed in the people around you. But then I didn't sense that that's what she meant, and so I asked her, who looted? And she said, well, everybody looted, but mostly the police. And my eyebrows went up, and I said, the police were looting? And she said, yeah, that they had. And then she said, and they began it, and they broke into every store. And it worked like this. The police would go into the stores, take what they wanted, then the rockheads, and I stopped her there, and I said, who are the rockheads? I suspected she meant drug dealers, and she did. And then the public. So there was sort of a pecking order in the looting. Police, drug dealers, then the public. And so I didn't question her in detail, partly because it's difficult for me to understand her, and partly because I wasn't sure she was able to tell me, even in her own sort of pidgin English, everything I wanted to know, or wanted to know from her. One thing, though, was that I wanted to know, what was this relationship between the police and the rockheads that would give them second dibs on the looting? And she said, well, she'd grown up here, and she'd gone to high school with some of the police and some of the rockheads. And she said they hung out together in high school. In other words, they had some of the same characteristics and interests, so were sort of birds of a feather, but that had divided later, and some had gone to the police, and some had gone into what you might call independent business. But more than that, when I asked other people for corroboration of this story, they told me that the police in Algiers make $15,000 a year, which is clearly not enough to get along on. So the police must augment their income with something else. The implication that Gail had given me, that the police and the police and the drug dealers had together looted to some extent, and had an understanding together, may go a long ways to explain why the police were looting at all. In other words, the rockheads, as Gail calls them, were the other end of a business that both the drug dealers and the police are engaged in, so that they already had established relationships, and when it came to looting, those relationships remained the same. Her daughter chimed in at some point, yeah, and I went down to the Walmart to get diapers for the baby, but I couldn't get in because the police were in there with shopping carts, and they were getting what they wanted. And you know, I had to wait till the next day before I could get into that Walmart. And before I got in, it had burned down. And this sort of gets us to the story of Gretna. Gretna and Algiers are adjacent to one another, so that they're sort of sister communities. And they look the same, and it looks to me the same sort of population living in both, which is mixed, a very cosmopolitan area. And none of these stores in Gretna were looted. It was the Gretna police chief who had stopped the people trying to escape from downtown New Orleans, but that same police chief had successfully stopped or prevented all looting in Gretna. And so what I take from that is it can be done. If a police chief didn't want looting, he didn't have to have it. Neither Gretna or Algiers was flooded either, so they suffered the same sort of wind damage as one another, and they're in the same geographic location on higher ground that doesn't flood. So I thought they were a pretty good double-blind study of the powers that be, looting, and what can and can't happen given the political will of the powers that be when they're running their police forces. I want to talk now about evictions. The eviction coordinator, I guess there are two eviction coordinators for Common Ground. One's name is Jinka, and the other is Jeremy. And I happen to know Jeremy's last name because I spent more time with him, and it was Jeremy Prickett. Jeremy says there's 1,000 evictions a day being processed in the courts in New Orleans. If so, that amounts to sort of a third disaster in New Orleans, all of which are primarily man-made. The first two being the increased size of storms due to global warming, and the second being the lack of a human response from the politicians, the national and state and local government, to the human predicament of the flooding and storm damage. And the third being these evictions, which are entirely a human business. The evictions are the result, partly, of FEMA money being given to landlords and to big developers, which makes them very gung-ho to upgrade their projects or their rentals and get twice the rent money that they were getting pre-Katrina, post-Katrina. They look at the populations in their buildings, are reasonably assured that they're not going to be able to double the rents on the existing population. And so the FEMA money predisposes them to want to get rid of the population that they have, fill the building up with people who can pay twice the rent. Jeremy and Jinka and others attempt to stop these evictions. They were and are carried on illegally, repeatedly, with support of the police and the courts, despite the illegalities. Mayor Nagin outlawed or put a moratorium on evictions until October 27th. This seemed to have had no effect on landlords who were actively evicting residents. And an eviction in New Orleans could be the usual kind of thing where you get, 10 days notice. But the most typical eviction is a 3-day notice, and it's not untypical to have no notice or a 3-hour notice or a 10-minute notice. And the notice is, get your stuff out of here, I want you gone now, or in 3 days, or in 10 days. Jeremy and Jinka, through any means they can come up with, have sought to stop this exodus of the poorest people, because they're not going to find any place else to rent. I mean, maybe a few will, but it's my guess and their guess that the majority of these people being evicted will then be homeless and without resources, or virtually without resources, besides whatever government handouts they may be able to garner. But government handouts are much harder to get when you don't have a telephone and a stable address. So it could be that they'll just be homeless. And we're talking about elder women and children and single parents and whole families and whatever. Another process in the political system that is driving evictions is that there are these various plans, and I can't describe them in detail, but to convert HUD housing into private housing so that the rents are no longer subsidized and that the conditions of the housing are no longer set by federal policy but are set just by the landlord. So, in other words, even if the housing was built by tax dollars and the subsidies were a function of tax dollars, that the now profitable building is being given to private individual, the landlord. And FEMA money and HUD money, that's housing and urban development money, go into converting these projects into private sources of income for landlords. But also, the evictions are driven in part by the destruction of so much housing stock in New Orleans. As I would stand in Malik's front door and just look at the houses around me, about 4 out of 5 of them had a blue tarp on the roof. In other words, there had been significant wind damage, even though there had been no flooding in Algiers. And some of the wind damage was just a few tiles off a roof, but some of it had been the complete collapse of the structure, too. and everything in between, so that there was significant damage all around, and some of it rendering those houses uninhabitable for the time being, or until sufficient money and resources turn up to fix the house. Many floors got ruined when the wind tore off enough of the roof to let the rain in. So housing stock in New Orleans is under a new pressure as people return, because there simply isn't enough of it. This also naturally has the effect of driving these evictions, in that there's the market for housing is drawing in the most able to pay, the people most able to return and put their lives back together, so the middle and upper middle classes. So these combined pressures on the poor of New Orleans, which are largely the ex-slaves of New Orleans, have created this catastrophe in which evictions are occurring at 1,000 a day in the courts. The evictions are also aided by the police in several ways. One is when the 3 days or 3 hours or 10 days are up, the police often will play the heavy in throwing people's stuff out and people out. But more than that, some of the landlords and the police have a rather cozy relationship, such that Jeremy describes the landlords when he shows up. In other words, when Jeremy shows up, the landlords immediately call a number they have locked into their cell phones, which is a particular policeman. And that policeman then comes up to throw Jeremy off the property as he seeks to assist the evictees with their issues. The police also show up at 2 in the morning to visit people in buildings that are slated for eviction. And another technique that the landlords use is to begin the remodeling, but begin it at 6 in the morning, so that people are awakened again. You know, perhaps they've been visited by the police at 2 and are wakened up again, you know, with jackhammers and table saws at 6 in the morning. There's also threats made, and this is very common, for a tenant to be told that a truck may hit them, that they may be found face down in the river, or any other kind of threat. And also told lies about their legal status. In other words, the landlord will insist that it's legal to give a 3-day eviction notice. Well, it's not. And so many of those evictions occurred prior to the moratorium, that clearly the landlords were not even attempting to stay within their legal limits. If you want to know more about evictions, you can go to the web and type in www.no-heat.org and go to the links at the left on the bottom and click the link, and there'll only be one link there, and that's Jeremy's weblog on evictions.